Good evening. My name's Paul, and I was never meant to be an alcoholic. But I think I've adjusted quite well. The longer it goes, the better I've adjusted. In fact, I thoroughly enjoy being an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic by mistake. I don't even look like an alcoholic, well, except when I'm drinking. Today I'm glad to be an alcoholic. I thoroughly enjoy being an alcoholic. I just love being an alcoholic. And in fact, if that bothers you to hear me say that, it's just too damn bad. I like being an alcoholic. I like being here. Jack said he was glad to be here. I was kind of tired when I got here and was kind of running down after a busy weekend and all that. And yet, the more the people came in and the more I got energized with what's going on here. And being around a bunch of alcoholics really stimulates me. And I think it was great to start off the cruise with that little book. I think that was delightful. Thank you for that. That's real good. I had another profound thought there, but I lost it. It's your loss. I'll think of it afterwards, but you'll never know. One of the things I noticed is that we had a show of the hands of the alcoholics, but there are a lot of other people here too. I mean, to me, this is an AA meeting, but the impression I get is that our meetings on something like this are pretty much generic meetings. And I was going to say anything goes, but I was a little afraid of that. You don't have to be an alcoholic to be at these meetings. And in fact, let's see the hands of the people who are not alcoholics and may or may not belong to another 12-step program. That's great. Let's give them a hand. Then there are people who belong to other 12-step programs like CA, NA, OA, any kind of A. Let's raise your hands too, that you belong to another one of the 12-step programs. Yeah, let's give them a hand. And at all our meetings, everybody's welcome, especially like the attitude adjustment meetings at 10 o'clock each day. Everybody's welcome to them, especially especially the Al-Anons. They need all the attitude adjustments they can get sometimes. But another thing I noticed too, and I've had this happen before, this is a wonderful room in which to have a meeting, in the sense I've never been to a more expensive room than this one, but for an AA meeting. But one of the things that always bugs me about cruises is that at the end of the cruise, at the very end of the cruise, everybody is giving out their address and phone number and greeting each other, and they're friends. But it takes the whole cruise to get to that point. And that doesn't seem appropriate for a bunch of people like us. And even though this is a terrible room in which to do it, I think everybody ought to get up and introduce themselves to at least three other people that they don't particularly know. Not the people you came with, but somebody else. It'll take some acrobatics to do it, but let's do it anyhow. What's the difference? Anything worth doing is worth, if it's worth it, it'll be worth the trouble. Anyhow, my name's Paul, and I'm still an alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
And another thing about this trip, no matter how much fun you're having at any particular time, I want you to, and no matter how much it costs you and all that, I want you to realize that at every moment you are actually treating your disease. This is the best disease you could possibly have. We're doing something like this as part of the treatment. We even have a textbook on it. It says this is our basic text, and it's a textbook on how to diagnose and treat and recover from a major medical illness. And I've studied a lot of medical texts and about a lot of I've studied about diagnosis and treatment of diseases I've never even seen. Kwashiorkor, Tutu Gamuchi fever, and lots of exciting things like that. And I don't care if I ever see them, but this is the only disease that I know of where in the textbook on how to recover from it includes the statement, and it does include this statement. In fact, I'm fascinated by where it is in the textbook. And in the textbook, we have 12 steps that we read tonight. If you didn't hear them, I'll read them again, didn't I? I've heard them read faster, and I've heard them read other ways. I never heard them read louder, but it's such drama. I almost feel like I ought to put on an act up here. After you do all the steps, which are covered in the first 164 pages of the book, on page 132, as I've said many times, it's right in the, I'm fascinated by the fact it's right in the very, very middle. The very, very middle. I even counted it. There are 16 lines above it, and there are 16 lines below it, and there are two extraneous words before it, and two extraneous words after it. And in the very, very geometrical middle of page 132, in the big book, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life, and it's a part of our recovery. And if you're not enjoying your recovery, probably something. Well, now let me say it for myself. If I'm not enjoying my recovery, there's something I'm not working my program right. If I don't enjoy this day, if I don't enjoy this cruise, it's something wrong with the way I'm doing. Something wrong with my attitude. In fact, they were announcing that today over the loudspeaker that. Hal here was trying to get me to tell you that they forgot to make the announcement about the lifeboats. That if the lifeboats are needed, that the Al-Anons are supposed to wait until all the alcoholics get on. I wouldn't even repeat a story like that. So I'm not this. But it. The devil made me forget what I was saying now. Or one of the Al-Anons hexed me. I love Al-Anon. I go to Al-Anon every Monday noon. And Max goes to AA with me, and I go to Al-Anon. And we have our two Ala dogs. They go to both our meetings, AA and Al-Anon. They go to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. Well, they have nicer personalities than a lot of people are trying to say. Anyhow, as I say, I was never meant to be an alcoholic, and I got here by mistake. I was, I had a brain tumor, is what it was, and I, was nothing funny about a brain tumor. As a matter of fact, it took me a while to figure out that I had a brain tumor. Because what I was doing, I was losing weight, and I had convulsions, and I had daily headaches, and I had this sense of impending insanity, and I thought I was going crazy, and all these things were happening. And I thought, I need a good medical workup. And so I did some lab work on me, and I did some a bit of a physical on myself, and checked my liver and pounded around. I sat down and had a consultation with me. And, well, I happened to be the best diagnostician I knew at the time, and I knew my history better than anybody else. And I sat down and went over all these symptoms and all these findings, and it was perfectly obvious to me. I had a brain tumor, and I would die, and you'd all be sorry, by God. And as a matter of fact, when I stopped and think about it, I was under the care of the most prominent neurologist in Orange County. And he was treating me with Dilantin and phenobarbital for convulsive disorder. He didn't know why I had convulsions. He didn't think to ask me if I drank, and I didn't think to tell him. And I was taking this Dilantin and phenobarbital, and when he couldn't figure it out and kept on having convulsions, he decided to send me back to the Mayo Clinic. And I figured, well, that's a good place to get treated. And I went back there to Rochester in December. November of 66 or something, and which is a great time to go to Rochester, Minnesota. We took 9 days or something like that, doing all these tests and stuff. And at the end, I went back to get my final report and have the neurosurgeon tell me that I had a brain tumor. And instead of telling me that, he said, "Well, before we finish," he said, "I think you ought to talk to our staff psychiatrist." And I thought, well, that's a strange way to look for my brain tumor. But then I realized it looked a lot of funny places for my brain tumor. So I went to see him, and next thing I knew, I heard this steel door slam shut, and they locked me up in the nut ward. And it hadn't really surprised me that I was training Max. Max was my problem. I'd send her to 4 different psychiatrists, and when it ended up at the nut ward, I wasn't all that surprised, but when she was the one that went home, I was amazed. And I wanted out of that dump, and they had me in with the schizophrenics and the crazy people, and I didn't feel that was. In fact, they made that, don't ever go to the Mayo Clinic around Christmas time. I don't know if they're still doing it, but then you had the iced Christmas cookies, and I hate ice Christmas cookies. I remember the nurse coming in and taking me by the hand and taking me down to the Christmas cookie icing party. And I didn't want to go to the Christmas cookie. The thing is, I've had a lifelong dislike of icing Christmas cookies. When I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio, my oldest sister loved to ice Christmas cookies, and she made all kinds of Christmas trees, angels, Santas, and deers, and all kinds of Christmassy cookies, and many different kinds of colors of icing, and different kinds of things to put on them, which was all okay, except we had a Christmas cookie contest, and you had to see who could ice the prettiest Christmas cookie. Well, I didn't like icing Christmas cookies when I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio, and I didn't like icing Christmas cookies when I was a big shot doctor on the nut ward of the Mayo Clinic. And she would guide my hand in the icing and smash it onto a cookie. I don't know how many cookies we crumbled before I told her what she could do with her cookies. And I went back to my room, by God, and went back to my, it was a cell is what it was. And one of those places where you turn off the lights, but the lights don't go off. They just go down so they can watch you. You're not going to commit suicide in their ward, by God, you know. So they keep an eye on you all night long. I got out. It wasn't a very nice place. I got out of there, and I told Max that. You can't get out of a place like that unless you have somebody sign out for you. And I had nobody with me but these 2 little kids, 2 adopted daughters, and Max. And Max wasn't being at all cooperative. And so I finally threatened her. I told her, if you don't do this, I'll never speak to you again. And she decided to do it. She since then thought, what a stupid idea that was. She had a great opportunity and passed it up. But I got out of there and got back on the plane and got back to a home where they treat me with more respect, and went to see this other psychiatrist, and he talked to me for 45 minutes, and they talked to Max for 10 minutes, and he locked me up in the local network. Bad bit about that place was they were fascinated with leather belts. You can't get out of there. You can't graduate unless you learn how to make a leather belt or something useful like an ashtray or something. I didn't want to make leather belts. I didn't like being on the nut ward. I didn't like making leather belts. They were fanatics on it. They were really. I never. Seen a place where there were such fanatics on you learning how to make leather belts. And they tried to tell me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belts. And I told them, I have a wall and it has licenses and certificates and diplomas and framed papers, a whole wall of them to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence. And I don't see how my life would be improved in any way for me to know how to make leather belts. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. Well, that wasn't my fault. That's the fault of the occupational therapist. I've always known that if you don't understand a thing well enough so you can explain it to me so I understand, then you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. And that stupid girl had explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. I didn't want to make leather belts. I remember sitting there in the nut ward. If you don't make leather belts, there's not a lot to do on a nut ward. And I sat there thinking about the misdiagnoses and poor medical management and things that had gone wrong, that a nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And while I was thinking that, this dumb psychiatrist, who couldn't see that my problems were strictly marital, walked up behind me and said, asked me, would I mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, my God, Doc, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? I didn't know anything about alcoholism, didn't want to know anything about alcoholism. All I knew about alcoholics was if you treat one, they'll all start coming to you. And then if people find out you treat alcoholics, all the good patients won't come anymore. So all you'll have is alcoholics. And they never pay their bill or keep their appointments anyhow. But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I said yes, and in no time at all, just in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room, yelling at the top of his voice, "My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic." Ha 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 ha! I was embarrassed and for him. God Almighty, here he is meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he can talk about for himself is that he's an alcoholic. I was much more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. Loud voice, he's shouting about us alcoholics, us drunks, Alcoholics Anonymous, loud voice. I kept thinking, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? These people all think I'm a nut, why don't we just leave it at that? And his story, he told his whole story. All I remember about it was it went on and on and on and on, and it was very, very, very loud. And the only other thing I remember was that it ended. I know how it ended. He ended up by saying, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it. You know, but I'll go, because I figured you'd go back and squeal at that dumb psychiatrist." And we went to a meeting. I have no idea what the meeting was like. I don't remember anything about it. Remember, I don't even know how many meetings he took me to before I knew what meeting I was at. I don't know who led, who read, who prayed, who said anything. I hear people give great talks about their first meeting, but I don't remember anything about mine. I don't remember anything about the meeting, but I know it had a very profound effect on the psychiatrist. He was delighted. And he was very interested in that. He wanted to know what the meeting was like. He wanted to know what other kind of meetings do they have. What's this about a book? What's this about steps? He said, "What other kind? Well, how often they have meetings? When are you going to go?" I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist, and he's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to before I got him sober. So I went to all the meetings I could, and finally got enough brownie points and earned my discharge button and got out of there. I had no intentions of going back to meetings anymore. Why would I? Wasn't an alcoholic. The problem that I had, though, was that it turned out that Max liked the meetings. Not even an alcoholic. And she likes the meetings. Once I found out she liked meetings, and I decided, well, if she didn't act right, I wasn't going to go anymore. I was not going to go to AA. Well, I said that once too often, and she got where she couldn't do drive the freeway, but she did it anyway. She got in the car and drove down the freeway and went to meetings by herself. And I found myself sitting at home by myself drinking while my non-alcoholic spouse was off laughing it up at an AA meeting. I had to go back to the meetings to find out what they were laughing about. I found out alcoholics laugh at anything. It seemed stupid to me, the things they laughed at, and I kept it going, and I apparently went to one meeting too many, and one night I found myself laughing with them, and I haven't had a drink since. Took 7 months. I think I went to one meeting too many. After seven months of meetings, and turned into a very mild, very, very mild alcoholic. When I first became alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all. Almost a non-alcoholic. I think if I could have avoided that last meeting, I could have still be out there. But I became a very mild alcoholic. In fact, I was a mild alcoholic. I was kind of like allergic to alcohol kind of alcoholic. But I wasn't. I had a list of things. I wasn't a wino. I wasn't a lush. I wasn't a drunkard. I certainly wasn't a skid row bum. In fact, at the men's stag meeting, you go around the room and I say, my name is Pete, I'm an alcoholic, my name is Paul, I'm an alcoholic, I'm Joe, an alcoholic. We had a guy named Jack. He was an ex-con, big guy. And he'd come to Jack and he'd say, my name is Jack and I'm a drunk. And I, oh, how disgusting. And I think, you may be a drunk, you even look like a drunk, but I'm an alcoholic. But the problem with that was that I had to become an alcoholic so I could quit drinking, is what happened. But in order to say quit, I had to keep going to meetings. But by going to meetings, I kept getting reinfected. And so today I am much more alcoholic than I was when I first became alcoholic. Really much more. And when they tell you it's a progressive disease, they're not lying. It really is. It's progressive. I kept getting reinfected, and that's where I got my alcoholism. I was taught in medical school and wherever I grew up knowing. In fact, my biggest problem when I got to AA was I couldn't learn anything because my head was already so full of knowledge that wasn't true. I had to unlearn a bunch of stuff to make room for something I could learn. But I always knew that you became an alcoholic. If you became an alcoholic, you got to be an alcoholic by drinking alcohol in bars. And that I didn't become an alcoholic by drinking alcohol. I got drunk drinking alcohol, and I got my alcoholism from other alcoholics. And there aren't any alcoholics in the bars. All the alcoholics are in the AA meetings. I've always been impressed with how many alcoholics you see in AA meetings. I mean, you sit out here tonight, you take any AA meeting, they say, all the alcoholics raise their hand, and they'll raise. Some of them go two hands, they'll wave. They think it's real funny to be an alcoholic. Yeah. Try that in a bar sometime. not one of the bars on the boat. They may throw you overboard or something. I don't think you get the same reception here. But there are no alcoholics in the bars. They're all in the AA meetings. And you get alcoholism from other alcoholics. And I'm convinced it's a virus. It goes in through your ears and affects your brain. That's how I got it. I'd listen to people. In fact, if you're here, there's the hands of people that are non-alcoholics. That you're the ones that are in danger. You really are. It's not funny. I mean, you better keep your mind wide open. Keep your mind wide open so whatever goes in goes right on through. Because if you hear something this week and you get the thought, boy, I didn't do quite that, but I felt like that when I did what I did. You know, I wonder if I'm you're an alcoholic. And the minute you suspect it, you've already got it. It's already too late. And you won't get any sympathy at an AA meeting. You say, you turn to the person next to you and say, well, I think I might be an alcoholic. I say, oh, we got another one. Put your hand up. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah. You think they got a bonus for every new member or something. And what I find is that I keep getting reinfected and getting worse and worse. I not only have my alcoholism worse, but I even got to be a a bit of a pill problem, let's see. I never became an addict. I mean, I would never got that bad or anything. But I took a few pills. I mean, I know I wasn't addicted, because the only way you can get addicted, according to doctors, is you have to abuse the pill. The only way to get addicted to a pill is to abuse it. And I don't even know how to abuse a pill. How do you abuse a pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know? Stomp on the thing? Or verbally abuse it? You dirty, rotten little pill, aren't you? Yeah. I always treated the pills with, actually, they were little tiny pills. I mean, you could tell just to look at them, they're very mild. And I was very careful where I carried them, even. I used to carry them with my change. And people say, you got change for a dollar? And I say, yeah. I go like that. And they say, oh, you carry second all around in the daytime. So I put it over with my keys. And I'd go to get in the car and I'd take the keys out. And the Quaalude run down the street, you know. And the damn thing would always run faster than I could run. And I didn't dare stomp on it or I'd abuse it. And so I never abused the pills. In fact, I never ever took a pill. I never ever took a pill unless I had the precise symptom that only that pill would relieve. I mean, I either had it or I could feel it coming on. You know? So that every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time and prescribed by a doctor and taken according to directions. So anyway, I ended up getting AA, getting sober, working the steps, getting the sponsor. Even that I didn't do right. I was talking to a friend of mine who was sober a month or two longer than I was. He and his wife and Max and I used to go to meetings together, speaker meetings. And the men's side group was picking on me because I didn't have a sponsor. They said I thought I was too smart, didn't need one, and a lot of nasty things like that. And on the spur of the moment, I said to him, why don't you be my sponsor? And he said, well, I'll be your sponsor if you'll be my sponsor. And I said, well, I don't know if they allow that. I mean, sounds kind of incestuous to me. But we decided to try it, and I had to study up on the steps so I could be ahead of him, and he had to study up on the steps so he could stay ahead of me, so that now he calls me because I'm his sponsor, and I call him because he's my sponsor, so we call each other twice as often, and we stay in twice as sober, and we're both, and the end of, this is July now, the end of this month, we'll both be sober 28 years, and so it's working well for us. And, don't bother. You're nowhere near as impressed as I am. I mean, I'm really impressed. I haven't had a drink or a pill in that length of time. I haven't had a drink or a pill in almost 28 years. And I found out that's the way it is in AA. We don't drink. We don't take pills. And we just don't drink. I mean, we even float around on floating bars like we're here, but we don't drink. We don't even drink when we deserve a drink. We don't even drink when we want to drink. And that's just, we just don't drink. And that's just, that not drinking has had a lot to do with my being sober. But my problems today aren't due to my drinking. I don't have a problem today as a result of drinking. I haven't had a problem as a result of drinking since the last time I took a drink. Any problem I have today is a problem result of my thinking. All my problems today, any problem I have today is a thinking problem. I don't even have a problem unless I think I do. And conversely, I have never ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. I mean, if I think I have a problem, I have a problem. If I think it's a big problem, no matter what you think, it's a big problem. If I think it's just a little problem, no matter what you think, just a little problem. I alone determine whether or not I have a problem and the size of my problem. And I have to work on my problems, and I have to keep focused on them, because if I don't, they'll get tired waiting for me and go find somebody who'll give them the attention they want. I find the problems are very fickle. They just won't wait around for it. In fact, at home, I always give out my phone number. Max and I live in 714 area, along with all the other people in bankrupt Orange County. And 240-3940. Can't give you my phone number here because I don't have one, but we were in the M73 or something like that. And I hope that if you see me walking around, interrupt me because I'm probably thinking. And and if I have the least little bit of a lost look, be sure and point me in the right direction. I've only been lost three times so far on this boat, and I have more trouble all the way through. But I hope to spend a lot of time talking to all of you, I'd like for you to interrupt me because I need that. Because I'm probably, if you're not talking to me, I'm probably working on the problem. And that's the worst thing I can do with the problem, is to think about it, because my mind puts energy into whatever I think about. And it goes into, it's like a laser beam or an ultraviolet light or a searchlight. It just makes it grow. It's just that I can take any little problem and just make... I don't even have to start with a problem. I can start with a non-problem. Well, hell, that's no problem. Oh, I suppose if you thought about it a little bit, it could be a bit of a problem. You know? And I get to wondering if it could be a problem, you know, and thinking about it. And as I'm thinking about it, I'm watching it grow. And I finally get fascinated with what, and pretty soon I'm thinking, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. You know? And the reason it's a good thing I'm looking at it is because everybody else is missing it. And then somebody distracts me, and then I get pulled away from the thing, and it just won't wait around for me. It just disappears, and I have to start out with a new problem. I don't have any trouble finding them because the people in my head look for problems for me. I don't know how you think, but I think by somebody talking to me. So they talk. If I'm awake, I hear somebody talking to me. Actually, if I'm asleep, they keep talking, and they talk all the time. As long as I'm alive, they'll be up there talking, talk. That's all they do. All these people in my head just sit up there and they talk. They never do any work. They just talk. And the quality of my life isn't determined by what happens so much as it's determined by who of the people up there I listen to who are interpreting what happened. As they're saying whether it's good or bad or whatever. In fact, my quality of my relationship with Max. This guy up there that's obsessed with her and watches her all the time and reports back to me what she's doing. And he doesn't particularly like her. Never really has. I'm always watching for her. Did you notice the tone of voice in which she's talking to you? Does that woman know who she's talking to? And yet there's another one up there that's just as obsessed with her, and he thinks she's just terrific. Thinks she has a great sense of humor. Thinks I should be grateful because she's still so active in Al-Anon. She went to AA meetings even when I didn't go. And it's always telling me nice things about her. And my relationship with Max depends mostly on which one of the two guys up there I listen to. And I have a choice. I didn't know I had a choice. When I was drinking, I didn't have a choice. But in sobriety, I have a choice of who I listen to. And it's an important thing for me to know that. In fact, among all the people in my head and all the conversation and chatter that goes on up there, one of the most important things I found is that in the center, in the very, very center of all that noise and confusion, there's a center of absolute calm. And that's where my higher power is. That's where my higher power is. And I didn't know that. And not knowing it is a lot like not having it be true. But now that I know that, I realize that I can't go anywhere that my higher power hasn't come with me. So I'm never alone. And even, I used to have trouble sleeping, and it was a big problem. But now, when I awake in the middle of the night, it's kind of like my higher power has nudged me awake. It says, let's talk. And it becomes a very spiritual time to be awake. And whenever I'm about to go into a problem area, I'll go, he's right with me and I can talk to him about it. In fact, along that line, Max and I, when I awaken in the morning, I will say the Serenity Prayer, the Third Step Prayer, and the Seventh Step Prayer. And then at breakfast, Max and I recite those prayers, do some reading, and have a meditation. And then throughout the day, frequently, I will say those three prayers. And especially if I'm going into a problem area, I'll turn my, tell God, I offer myself to thee, and I also offer the problem or the situation to do whatever he wants and relieve me of this bondage of self. And it's very comforting to me. I have a great relationship with my higher power, and my relationship with Max is getting better and better, which is remarkable considering the fact that she drove me to drink for 28 years, and now we've been in sobriety for 28 years. And so we've been married 56, and we've known each other for over 70 years. And as a matter of fact, that's a very relevant thing. A lot of people don't know how they got to be alcoholic. I do. Max was an orphan. And when I was 4 years old, my father bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio, and I grew up in a drugstore. Better living through chemistry was the way of life from the very beginning. But next door to the drugstore was where Grandma Genslein was raising the little Genslein girl, the orphan. And she also had two, Grandma Genslein had two alcoholic sons, the Genslein boys. And as we were growing, Max and I were growing up, it was common for the Genslein boys to be in the Alliance Review as being locked up again in jail for common drunk. And as Max and I were growing up, going to school and so on, my family didn't like for me to play with the Genslein girl because they were afraid that when we grew up, we might get married and I might turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right. I'm an alcoholic by marriage. But the point is that here in AA, I have found an answer to it. The thing that I have found is that I finally found out that I am an alcoholic, and I found an answer to my alcoholism, a way of life, how to live sober. And it turns out that way of life, that 12 steps, are the answer to any and every problem I've had, ever had, and I'm sure ever will have. I used to think my problems were my problem, but it turns out alcohol, the solution, was the problem. The answer to that problem turns out to be the answer to all the other problems. It's a way of life that I wouldn't have it if I weren't an alcoholic. Let me just say this, and I'll sit down. My life from the beginning until July 31st, 1967, was on a downhill course. Not a straight line down, it was up and down, up and down. Just enough ups to keep me confused. And on July 31st, 1967, I went to one meeting too many and turned into a mild alcoholic. And my life has been getting progressively better ever since. And now again, it's not a straight line, up and down. Some days, some weeks, some years are better than others. But the trend is up and up. And it seems to me the only limit as to how high that can go is how long I can stay around doing what I'm doing. And I want all I can get out of this program. I want all I can get, knowing that I can't possibly get it all. I don't think anybody can live long enough to get everything this program has to offer. But I want all the experiences, all the AA stuff that I can get. I want as much of that as I can get. But the thing that really fascinates me is the point of that V, the fact that it accepted that one reality of my life, that yes, you are an alcoholic, and it completely changed the course of my life. Completely changed the course of my life. It makes me think, if I could do that with every reality of my life, what would my life be like? If I could totally accept every reality of my life, not approve of it. Acceptance is not approval. I did not approve of being an alcoholic anywhere along here, and I didn't approve it on July 31st of 67. But now that approval comes retrospectively, not it doesn't precede it, it comes afterwards. Today I thoroughly approve of being an alcoholic. And I was afraid that if I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, that would be like giving it my stamp of approval. And but approval and acceptance have really not. Approval seeking is an impediment to acceptance. And, I think the, I think I've talked long enough. I love you all very much. So I'm getting hungry. Let's go eat pretty soon. I'll talk in the meantime. Love you. Bye-bye.